Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
Boy, that made everybody get really quiet, didn't it?
Okay, now I think we're recording.
All right, I believe we are. Why don't we go ahead and start, Jim? And I'll kick things off and then turn it over to you. This is Dr. Karen Johnson. It's Thursday, May the 10th, 2007. This is the oral defense of the dissertation of James Brown. The people in attendance are myself, Dr. Karen Johnson, his mentor, Dr. Ronald Williams, who's a committee member, Dr. James Conley, who's a committee member, Dr. Hawes, who's been a reader and advocate for Jim along the way, and William Pells, who has assisted with the stats and other portions of advising, if you will, of Jim's project. At this time, it's my pleasure to turn this presentation over to Jim, and he's going to spend about 30 minutes telling us about the study that he's conducted, how he conducted it, what his major findings are, and what recommendations he future research in this area. Jim, did someone just join us?
I think a few folks did.
Yes.
Whoever had joined us just identify themselves?
Hello. Eve Fogarty, Catherine Brown.
And the other person?
Eve Fogarty.
Hi, Eve.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Catherine and Eve, what is your participation in this dissertation?
Just listening.
That's my mom, Dr. J.
Oh, okay. All right.
And a friend. I could say a lot of things, but I don't think I'm allowed to.
Oh, you know what? We're going to turn the tape recorder off later, and then you could.
We'll see.
Okay. All right, Jim. Thank you very much for letting me know who else was there. If you're ready to begin, let's do so.
Sure. We're all set. First of all, good afternoon and welcome, everybody. It's obviously a very exciting day for me after a nearly four-year journey to present to you some significant research that I think will be of great benefit to the profession that I'm in now in higher education administration. The title of the dissertation and the project is Quantitative Analysis of Employee Stress and Job Satisfaction at Two Upstate New York Colleges. As each of you, I know, have gone around and introduced yourself, but the team that really has constituted the core of all the group that I've been working with the last couple of years specifically in writing this is Dr. Karen Johnson, my mentor, Dr. Ronald F. Williams, who is the president of Herkimer County Community College and has been a both professional mentor and personal friend in this process, Dr. James Connolly, a member of my committee as well, Dr. Matthew Hawes, who's been a really, I would consider a committee member, but a reader for the project. Professor William Pells, who's here in Herkimer with me today for the live part of the presentation, has been a stalwart supporter and my statistics expert in analysis. And then someone who's not able to join us today, who I would consider is really the world expert in this field, Dr. Michelle Tiderly. You'll see her referenced throughout the presentation as someone who has conducted some significant research in the United Kingdom regarding higher education occupational stress and has really been a huge, huge asset to us. You'll see this slide a few times throughout the presentation, and it's a concept that is prevalent throughout the literature indicating that stress is multidimensional. There is not one way to measure stress. This is a particular area where the literature is very clear that stress, being multidimensional, has many facets to it, and you'll see that as the presentation develops. In my particular research. If you're looking at this particular slide, I won't read the slide to you particularly, but the key words here regarding stress in particular, and this is not a study of stress from a psychological perspective, but the key words that are important to understand here is stress being an interaction, having to do with relationships, individuals and their relationships in their environment, pressure, and how the individual adjusts and or adapts to their particular environment. The literature is very clear, both from Michaelides and Asimov, Tiderly in 2005 and 2007, that, again, stress being multidimensional, but supports both stress being a positive aspect to a job environment and also can also be a negative aspect. We tend to always focus on the negative, but stress, of course, does have an important positive aspect to it. For me, as a new higher ed administrator about 4 years ago, when I started doing my research with the University of Phoenix for my dissertation project, this was really an alarm bell for me. I was reading Dr. Tidley's study and saw in a 2003 survey in the United Kingdom specifically that 93% of the members of the higher education employees that they had surveyed suffered from work-related stress and 62% from excessive strain. We tend to think of jobs like police officers and emergency room doctors and so forth being under stress, but you'll see, I think, through this research that we identified some statistically significant differences and importance to show that there is stress in higher education. Even more importantly, what was interesting is that as I did my research, and you'll see a little more as we go on, that higher education stress in the United States is not something that's been prevalent. And Dr. Tidley in 2005 in her study was very clear saying that future research should provide separate benchmarks for academic and general staff. She was very specific in that in her findings. We tend to focus at a college and a university on the faculty, and in most cases. And what her research was yielding is that we need to spend more time researching the differences in the academic and the general staff as well. That helped to frame some of the conceptual framework for our overall study, which really is in three major areas. The first being educational leadership, which is, of course, the core of my program here at the University of Phoenix. The second piece in the human resources area. And the third, not as least important, but not a major focus in this particular research, is in the area of psychology. But these three areas are discussed in detail in my project, but in specifically, the two areas that we're focused on for this project were educational leadership and human resources. And specifically, the literature is very clear that educational institutions really are very uniquely poised to both study and to make changes in higher education stress or in stress research itself. Academics, of course, being an area that allows for research to be conducted. And interestingly, now turning that microscope inward on the institution and being able to make actual change within their own institution once stressors are identified, and negative stressors in particular. In addition to higher education leadership, the area of human resources, not only in higher education, but human resources in general, current literature as of 2005, identified a new phenomenon called presenteeism. Presenteeism is essentially a phenomenon where you're finding an employee who's coming to work, they're there, but they're really not there. And those increasing numbers were an alarm to me as I was doing the research, but also found that there was not a lot of research helping to identify what areas really were of significance. Presenteeism, again, essentially is where you've got the person coming to work with a higher degree of sickness, both physical and mental, psychological well-being, physical well-being, and they're relying more on employee assistance programs, and the need for those programs is something that's significantly growing, and the literature shows more of that support. More importantly, in 2005, Kaufman did a study where he identified saying that traditionally universities have always taken a paternalistic view of students, but they traditionally have not taken on a paternalistic view of staff. And that's something that the literature shows a gap and a need to be able to identify those areas. So as we develop both from the problem and the purpose perspective of the study, the role of any leader in an institution, whether it's a middle-level manager who's supervising individuals or the president of a college or an institution, needs to try to ensure a healthy work environment, both from a physical perspective and from a psychological perspective. And they need to identify those stressors that are negative stressors and be able to find ways to mitigate those stressors. Dr. Tidley studied both in 2005 and most recently in 2007, identified those needs as one of the key points that higher education leaders need to adopt, and that's being able to ensure that healthy work environment, identify the stressors, and do something to mitigate them. The need in this particular case is the problem, actually, is that occupational stress screening for higher education faculty and staff members is not prevalent within the United States and is needed in order to provide higher education leaders with an inventory of potential predictive characteristics that may contribute to occupational stress. Those areas are supported by research in 2003 by Beam, Brewer and McMahon in 2004, and Fisher in 1994, all supported that type of a structure, being able to empower higher education leaders and give them that information to be able to conduct mitigating activities and identify bad stressors in their institution. The purpose of this particular case, the purpose of my research and of this quantitative cross-sectional survey design was to examine the differences, if any, between 227 full-time and part-time faculty and staff members at two upstate New York colleges and their self-reported levels of stress and perceptions of job satisfaction. We selected a quantitative approach in this particular case. Literature is very clear in several, Cresswell in 2005, Dubé and Perry have a very extensive article in 2003, Newman in 2003 also supporting that the quantitative approach tends to be marked by objectivity and a lack of researcher bias. I wanted to be able to present something that was strongly supported and backed by using standardized statistical methods, which tend to mark quantitative research over qualitative selection in mixed methods. Not that those two other forms are bad methods of research, but in this case, I wanted to choose to do this, to utilize those standardized statistical instruments that are well-tested both in the literature and in the field of stress research. It's also used in quantitative research to confirm and disconfirm hypotheses in this particular case. And what we wanted to do is in an era of No Child Left Behind legislation, we now see higher education, which may be moving in that direction. Horn in 2004 did a study where he's beginning to see that the federal government is now almost requiring that all educational research be done in a quantitative fashion. It didn't make the qualitative researchers or mixed method researchers very happy, but the federal government is moving in that direction. I'm not saying that's necessarily a good or bad thing, but the literature supports the strength of quantitative research, and hence we selected that. A cross-sectional survey design was chosen essentially doing research at one point in time. In my particular case, we had both financial and time constraints. The research could not go on forever, certainly. The preference, though, the literature is very clear, the preference in doing stress research is longitudinal studies. I had neither the time or the financial resources to conduct a longitudinal research study, and hence a quantitative cross-sectional design, taking research at, or taking measurements at one point in time, was selected. We identified two key variables, four major variables, two independent variables and two dependent variables. Our independent variables were employee positions represented by faculty and staff. These were self-reported on the survey instrument that I'll be discussing shortly. And the other one is employee status, full-time employee versus a part-time employee. Again, these were self-identified on the particular on the instrument that the individuals returned. For the dependent variables, we identified two key areas that we wanted to study. One was the self-reported levels of stress, and the second one was self-reported levels of job satisfaction. The self-reported levels of stress are identified in this particular research by 11 of 12 scales within the instrument that we selected, each of those measuring some dimension of stress. And that focuses on the key point that I wanted to make, which is, again, going back to stress is multidimensional. You can't look at any one scale and just say that an individual or an organization overall is stressed. The 11 key areas involve work relationships, work-life balance, overload, job security, an individual's control, resources and communication, pay and benefits, the employee's commitment to the organization, and then the employee's perception of the organization's commitment to them. And then the two final areas are physical health and psychological well-being. Those calculated, the 11 of those individually measured, make up the dependent variable of self-reported levels of stress. The final area is job satisfaction, the self-reported levels of job satisfaction. In this particular instrument, that's represented by a scale called the Aspects of Job Scale, and that most likely correlates to the WAR job satisfaction scale and other instruments that it was used to compare against to establish that the importance of that. I'll go through now. We identified six and formulated six research questions, and then, of course, the null and alternate hypotheses. What I'll do is I'll review each of the six, and then we'll revisit them again as far as our findings in that particular section. The first research question that we identified is, does a statistically significant difference exist between employee position, meaning faculty versus staff, as categories of employees in higher education institutions in the United States, with respect to their self-reported levels of workplace stress at two upstate New York colleges? This first research question dealing again with the position, which is faculty versus staff, and levels of stress. The second research question deals with, does a statistically significant difference exist between employee position, employee position as categories of employees in higher education institutions in the United States with respect to their self-reported levels of job satisfaction? So this one deals with position and job satisfaction. The third research question is, does a statistically significant difference exist between employee status, which is full-time versus part-time, as categories of employees in higher education institutions in the United States with respect to their self-reported levels of workplace stress at our two upstate New York colleges that we utilize for our research base. The fourth question that we identified is, does a statistically significant difference exist between employee status, full-time and part-time, as categories of employees in United States higher education, and their self-reported levels of job satisfaction? So this one deals with job status, full-time and part-time, and job satisfaction. The fifth question that we identified is, does a statistically significant interaction exist between employee position, which is the faculty and staff, and employee status? In other words, is there an interaction between position and status at the two institutions that we research? And then the final research question that we identified, the sixth, is, does a statistically significant interaction exist between employee position and employee status? Again, this is position and status and job satisfaction. So those are the six research questions that we had identified in the process. The next section I'm going to discuss is the how we measured it, how we pulled everything together, and how we decided to collect all of our information. In the United States, there's about 3.2 million full-time and part-time employees working in higher education institutions. It's certainly not practical for us to reach out and try to study those institutions. And to do that, it's again not practical or cost-effective. So we decided to pick a target population. The overall population was all U.S. full and part-time higher education faculty and staff. And as I said, U.S. Department of Education said there's about 3.2 million of those. To focus that more in on a more manageable group, a target population, we focused on full and part-time higher education faculty and staff at two upstate New York colleges. And these were our target population, partially taken as a convenience sample to be able to both groups that were both willing and able to participate in the research, and also exhibited characteristics of the overall population in the United States. The results of this study, as you'll see, are not statistically, we're not statistically able to use the information to generalize to the entire population, but it is important to mention that the characteristics of both of these higher education institutions are similar, according to the Higher Department of Education, to what other schools look like across the country, what other faculty and staff, full-time and part-time, look like. So the similar characteristics of our random sample are an important aspect to keep in mind as we continue through the results. This is what the population looks like. We surveyed two institutions. The first is Institution A, and neither institution is identified in the research, but Institution A is a two-year comprehensive community college offering both associate's degrees and certificates. Institution B is a four-year comprehensive college, which offers bachelor's degrees, master's, and professional doctoral degree programs. And on this slide, you can see the breakdown. I won't go through each one, but you can see the breakdown of our total target population was 1,084 full-time and part-time employees, and you can see how they're spread across both institutions and faculty and staff. The actual sample itself, we'll come back to this a little later, but the actual sample itself, we drew a stratified random sampling, meaning that we essentially wanted to make sure that as best as we could, all of the members of the different strata were accurately represented in the research to allow us to draw some statistically significant conclusions. In other words, have a good response from each of the different strata. As you can see, our overall response rate was a little over 35%, 35.25%, and we'll go into that in a little more detail. But to draw this, what we were able to find is the literature is very clear that it's acceptable for a 5% error rate, looking at a 95% confidence level, is what the standard is. For ours, we ended up with a 4.4% error rate at 90% confidence, so we were good at that level. 5.2% error level at 95% confidence, so we were slightly over the 5% that we needed. But we mailed to 60% of each of the strata, hoping to be able to reach our numbers. But to achieve our 95% confidence rate with our 5% error, we needed 284 responses. We did not have the full 284 responses. And in our final response, we felt that we did not need to wait our results because we were so close with the 5.2% confidence level, rather error level, at the 95% confidence level. Collecting the data itself, how did we collect the information? How did we bring it in here? The literature, both in looking in the United Kingdom, and the literature in higher education, stress has essentially been focused in the United Kingdom, New Zealand, and Australia. That has been the main focus areas. The United Kingdom has been probably the front runner in this area, and Dr. Tidley, actually, again, I would again consider the world leader in this particular area. She's conducted two major research studies in the United Kingdom. Others have followed in Australia and in New Zealand, specifically in higher education. The instrument that we chose to utilize for this is called the ASSET instrument. It stands for a stress screening evaluation tool. And ASSET, and keep in mind, again, as we go through this whole review, ASSET is the first step. The issuance of the ASSET instrument, or as a stress screening tool in an organization, is the first step of a two-part screening operation. So in this particular case, we're not going to be necessarily telling why someone feels stressed in job security or why they feel that their resources and communications are not good. We're going to identify those stressors. The next step, which would logically follow in future research that we'll discuss in the end, is to go to the next level, which is then to probe further into the organization and further into each of the instrument's items to probe some of those causes. The ASSET instrument itself has 12 subscales. Again, we already went through very quickly. And again, the key part is each measuring some dimension of stress. The instrument itself is very strong. It has good convergent validity. In other words, it correlates with other measures of the same construct. High face validity and strong reliability, as evidenced through high Cronbach's alpha scores, alpha coefficients, which we'll show you both for our own study and for other studies as comparisons. And it has a strong pool of normative data, which is something that continues to grow both in the higher education field and in the non-higher education field. And the last part is why we selected this is that it's a shortened stress evaluation. The literature is very clear both in the U.S. literature and Dr. Tidley's literature, Michalides and Asimov, that long research instruments have yield low response rates. And they wanted to develop a shortened stress instrument, and ASSET was developed for this purpose. And as we can see, it has provided some strong data for our particular research. The instrument itself is broken into four scales: perceptions of the job, attitudes towards the organization, the individual's health, and then individual biographical information. Again, to support the use of a quantitative versus a qualitative or a mixed method study, this type of information is best collected in a quantitative instrument. And as we'll see, we found of the 12 scales that we studied in the ASSET instrument, that we identified five areas where there was statistically significant differences in overload, job security, resources and communication, pay and benefits, and then the aspects of the job, which is ASSET's measure of job satisfaction. Collecting the data was certainly the most significantly time-consuming part of all of the process. We utilized the ASSET instrument, which is a self-administered paper and pencil survey. We utilized Dillman's total design method. This was research that was done in 1978 by a gentleman by the name of Don Dillman, and he established a process of using multiple communications to enhance the response rates for surveys. This included pre-survey letters. The next phase was a letter that went out on the first day. We sent out an initial letter to the entire population of 1,084 individuals. 4 days later, we sent out the initial letter. 4 days later, we sent out the initial letter, another letter, which identified the survey and gave them instructions on completing it, and that all went out to the stratified random sampling. After that, And then approximately 3 weeks later, we sent out a reminder postcard. And that reminder postcard was very successful in our research, as you'll see, that triggered approximately 20 to 25 more responses as a result of that postcard. So it's all those people who called me up and said, you know, I got it, it's on my desk, I just haven't gotten to it. And then when the postcard came, that triggered them to send it out. So using the total design method was very successful in our particular case. The 1978 research in that particular area has been updated in 2005, but it was really dealing just with updates dealing with the Internet and how to maximize Internet. Now, this survey did have an Internet component to it. It was something that was not affordable to me as a researcher in this case. It was approximately $10,000 just to have the instrument modified to go online. So it is something that's available, and it's certainly encouraged for future research, but in this case it was something that was not affordable to be able to utilize. So we sent out 1,084 letters to the entire population. 661 was the final group of letters that were mailed to the stratified random sample, and then 227 of them actually ended up being usable surveys. And I'll talk a little bit more about what ends up being usable and what wasn't in just a few moments. I won't spend a lot of time on this. This is just a graphical representation of the asset model so that you can get a quick snapshot of the multiple areas, again, of the multidimensionality of stress, and to get an idea of how each plays against each other and impacts both as sources of stress and outcomes of stress. Again, I said you'll be seeing this several times because I want to keep reiterating that as we go through the research and as we look at the final results, stress is multidimensional. Up to this point, are there any questions at this particular point? Okay. We'll move into the analysis and the results.
Does anyone have questions of Jim before we move on?
I'm sorry?
I was asking if anyone has questions before you move forward.
Yeah, if I can just ask a question.
I didn't have any. I was busy putting the mute on and off.
Yeah, I understand, Jim. Someone said they had a question. Who was
that?
Just
a quick one, Jim. In order to increase response rates, how come you couldn't have mailed out 100% to all those potential respondents as opposed to 60%?
We used the research. Krejci and Morgan in 1970 did some research indicating what we needed to have a statistically significant sample. And we use that as a benchmark to decide that we didn't need to mail. It's not desirable always to mail to the entire population, and it also wasn't cost-effective for us, both from a printing and mailing perspective to do that. So we determined how many we needed for the statistically significant sample and then decided, more importantly, that we wanted the stratified random sample to make sure that all the different areas were represented equally.
Okay, thanks.
Are there any other questions at this point? Okay, we'll move into the... what I would consider the exciting part, which is what we really found. As I indicated earlier, there were 231 surveys overall that were returned. 227 of them were usable. Going through the institutional review process, informed consent certainly is an important part. The instrument itself has an informed consent checkbox on the front. And perhaps in the haste of completing the instrument, someone didn't check the box, and so hence we had to discard those particular instruments. And weren't able to use them. So there were 231 that were actually returned. Only 27 of them were usable surveys. All of the data was hand-entered by myself into SPSS, the statistical package for the social sciences. I utilized version 14, but several different versions were utilized in the analysis process, so it didn't affect the outcome. They're all worked together. We had a two-person entry process where I was doing the hand-entering myself, and we had an assistant who was reading the information off to me, and then I would go back and cross-check their information to make sure that what they were telling me, if it was a 1, it was actually a 1, a 2, and a 2, and so forth. The statistical analysis team consisted of primarily myself, Professor William Pels, who I would consider certainly a statistics expert, and Dr. Tiderly, who came in, I've actually been working with her the last couple of years, telling her about my research, and she came in and really helped us out in the end with some final statistical analysis and with the data entry and the getting all the information together. The asset instrument itself, the perceptions of job scale, has 37 individual items divided into 8 subscales. The attitudes towards your organization scale has 9 items that are divided into 2 scales. And then the Your Health category has 19 items that are divided into two subscales, which are the psychological well-being and the physical well-being. And then the supplementary information was collected also on the instrument to help us for further research. I should note at this point that an important aspect of this research is that we're generalizing to the aggregate population in our discussion of the final piece for this dissertation. But after this project is completed, I will then take the information that I have and create another appendix which will provide to both the presidents of both those institutions with institution-level data, which is an important aspect of the research. It has to be something that's actionable, and I think we found some areas that are certainly actionable that both presidents can look at and say, we could actually make immediate changes now or begin to look at changes for the institutions. And that's an important aspect to mention because that's critical on the front end that when we sent the information out to the survey participants that they knew this was not just an academic exercise. It certainly was from the perspective of going through the process, but it has some real life, real world meaning right now where we can make some significant changes. I call these dashboard indicators. It's just a quick look at some of the key areas. Again, we had 227 of 644 surveys were returned. That was a 35.25% overall response rate, 5.2% error at our 95% confidence level, so that's within tolerance levels of the literature. We found statistical significance in 5 of 12 asset subscales. In other words, a less than a 0.05 level of significance, which is, again, supported in the literature as far as the threshold for finding statistical significance. We used standardized tests. We used what we felt after discussing were the most robust tests over other ones. We utilized the analysis of variance used to determine whether there is a significant differences between two or more means at a selected probability level. The ANOVA was the most robust test in a 2x2 ANOVA specifically. The literature supports this. We researched and utilized also means and standard deviations for each subscale. We calculated Cronbach's alphas for each of the subscales. Does the scale measure what it's supposed to measure? And then we benchmarked it, not for comparison purposes for our research here, but we benchmarked it against Dr. Teiterle's studies in 2005 and 2007 to be able to see this, to make sure that we were in the ballpark of where her research was taking us. We saw this slide a little earlier. I won't spend too much time on it again. Again, it shows you a quick snapshot of where our final numbers fell with each of the individual strata, full-time and part-time. The next slide shows you some of the core descriptive statistics and showed that our means and standard deviations were consistent with previous research, specifically two major studies that Dr. Tridley had conducted in 2005 and 2007. And I should also know that these are consistent with the studies that were done in New Zealand and Australia as well. So our means and standard deviations are consistent within tolerance levels of other similar researches using the same scale. Our calculations of Cronbach's alphas, is it measuring to the extent to which the scale measures what it's supposed to measure? You show in the first column our current sample of our 227 individuals, and then compare that to Dr. Tiderly's study in 2005 and 2007, and again, find strength in our research compared to research done in the other areas around the world. And this goes, again, to support the reliability of the asset instrument, not only globally for future use, but supports it specifically for our study, showing where coefficients were at 0.70 or greater, which is the literature strongly supports is the threshold for showing those coefficients being strong. The next table shows specifically what I call the exciting table. This is really one that shows the main effect and interaction significance, where we found the less than 0.05 significant areas. And you can see in those five areas that are highlighted in yellow where we found statistical significance. The most exciting part, and again we'll discuss this more when we get to each individual question, is dealing specifically in the areas of overload and the employees' feeling of being overloaded, job security, resources and communication, pay and benefits, and aspects of the job, which again is assets measure of job satisfaction, individuals feeling dissatisfied in their particular role. This is just a snapshot to show you. I'm not going to go through each of the 12 scales with you. The summary table really will give you that specific information. But for each of the 12 scales of asset, we created these tables, which appear in the final dissertation product. One, the first being a table of means. This is particularly for overload, showing you a table of means for full-time versus part-time employees, and then faculty and staff. And what this shows you, and the way asset is interpreted, is the higher mean indicates a higher level of stress, the lower mean indicating a lower level of stress. That works for all of the instruments except for the aspects of job scale, which is a higher mean indicates a less satisfied individual or more dissatisfied. We also show, of course, the significance level for each one and the standard statistical reporting for an ANOVA report. For those five areas that we found statistical significance, we also included the a table of the marginal means or mean of the means, and that particular area for each of the 12 was constructed. Any questions up to this point? Okay. We'll go on now to look at the some more of the meat of the research, and that's responding to each of the different research questions. We'll go very quickly to review. The first question that we had was, does a statistically significant difference exist between employee position? Again, this one particularly dealing with position and levels of stress. And we found that there was no statistically significant difference, and thus the null hypothesis was not rejected in that particular case. The second research question dealt with position and job satisfaction. And there again, we found that the null hypothesis was not rejected and there was no statistical significance found. Where things got a little interesting was in the beginning with the third research question, was does a statistically significant difference exist between employee status, again, dealing with full-time versus part-time employees, categories of employees, and their self-reported levels of workplace stress. And here, we found statistical significance. We found a difference between status and stress. Again, the full-time versus part-time. Part-time employees indicated there were significantly higher levels of stress in terms of their job security, while full-time employees indicated that they had higher levels of stress, specifically dealing in the areas of work overload, poor resources and communication, and lower pay and benefits. It might be indicative of the fluid nature of a part-time position may explain a little bit about the heightened significance of this particular dimension of stress as far as job security goes. A part-time employee is, again, by its nature, a fluid individual. But an important part of this particular finding showing the difference in full-time and part-time employees, again, highlights the importance of the multidimensionality of the stress expressed by these full-time and part-time employees. This says to us as higher ed leaders that we need to look at these groups and then in these particular five areas and be able to now isolate, okay, why is job security? Is it just the fact that they're a part-time employee or is there something else that's going on in the background? And that second level of organizational stress screening is something that would yield those types of results. The full-time employees, which, again, organizations would tend to want to spend some more time on, but interestingly, though, large statistics in this particular study, both institutions rely heavily on part-time employees, mostly in the area of adjunct faculty, but some also rely on part-time staff in various capacities. But a key part here is that this has now isolated and identified key areas. The full-time employees say they're overloaded, they have poor resources and communications, and pay and benefits. Now, we could anecdotally say, well, everybody complains about they'd like to get more money and more benefits, but now the key is you've identified this as a stressor, and as a higher ed leader, we can now go out and look to see, now let's look further and find out what's really causing those levels of stress. The next research question that we identified also showed statistically significant indications, and that was in job status, and again, full-time and part-time, and job satisfaction. And job satisfaction in this case is expressed as a measure of job dissatisfaction. I'm not happy with my particular position. Full-time employees indicated that they were less satisfied, in other words, more dissatisfied with their jobs than part-time employees. though slightly more satisfied, but not significantly more satisfied with their jobs overall compared to the normative data. This research did not get into the normative data and looking at those tables and comparing us to the data in the United Kingdom or Australia or other areas. So we're not doing that kind of research, although that's something for future research to look at. But again, it identified that the full-time employees, for whatever reason, feel less satisfied or more dissatisfied in their particular role. This, again, parallels the multidimensional nature of stress. Job satisfaction shouldn't be looked at in isolation. And this is something that, again, highlights and says we need to look at full-time employees. In particular, in this case, full-time staff were less satisfied or more dissatisfied than full-time faculty. That was an interesting finding. Part-time employees were more satisfied than full-time employees. And again, this might be attributed to the inherent nature of their own position. But is that the case? Are they happy because they come in, teach a class, or work a short job and go to another position? Or is there something deeper that needs to be looked at because this is a significant population at both institutions? I want to take just a moment. I don't want to spend too much time quoting things here, but this is an important aspect of this. Dr. Tidley wrote her 2005 study, "A negative impact from ongoing changes in universities is now being reported in relation to academics productivity, as well as their health, well-being, and levels of stress and tension. Increased numbers and diversity of students, new teaching modalities, and unrealistic deadlines have left many staff feeling disconnected from their institutions and unwilling to exert extra effort on their behalf." That, I think, is the core of the changing nature of higher education around the world, but in particular in the United States and in those areas that we've identified specifically. The fifth research question, yes, we found a significance in the interaction that exists between position and status and levels of stress. And in this case, the null hypothesis was rejected. Full-time and part-time staff and part-time faculty felt less secure. Staff in general were significantly more stressed than faculty in three of the four asset areas. Let me say that again. Staff were significantly more stressed than faculty in three of the four asset subscales where we found significance. And those were in overload, resources and communication, and pay and benefits. So you can start to see the dots being connected here with those five areas and the issue of those differences in the particular areas. Finally, our sixth research question dealt specifically with whether there's a statistically significant interaction between employee position and status and self-reported levels of job satisfaction, and we did not reach levels of statistical significance, and thus the null hypothesis in that particular case was rejected. So what can we do now, and what are the real implications of the material that we've just gone through and highlighted? The implications specifically were for higher education leadership is that the results of this study might contribute to us being able to do something right now as higher education leaders. And it involves these several items that are here: proactively using the results to enact change, not using them only as an academic exercise, but taking the information as an aggregate, and then the information that I provide to these two specific institutions, being able to look at them and say, okay, we need to now look further at information as to how we can change these five areas where we found statistically significant differences. Again, in overload, I feel overloaded in my job. I don't feel my job is secure. I have poor resources in communication or experience poor resources in communication. I'm concerned about my pay and benefits, and I feel less satisfied in my job. And we found statistically significant differences in each of those five areas. The key part here is we get to identify, and we can almost, in some cases, predict occupational stressors in higher education. We've taken 12 dimensions of stress, and we've broken them down and found statistical significance in five of those areas. And to me, that was pretty surprising and pretty exciting. I didn't actually go into this, you know, with any preconceived notions, but to come out and now find that we found some statistical significance in the areas, I think says a lot for something that we can do right now to make changes. Committing resources is a key part for educational resources. We could take this, and someone who could read this could say, it's a good academic exercise, thanks, and put it back on a shelf. Or anyone who reads this, whether it's the two institutions' presidents or their leadership who look at this, or someone who might pick this up in some other area will look at it and say, you know, this represents at least part of what higher education looks like, and these are maybe five areas that we want to isolate in our organization to be able to see if we have these problems and how can we change them to get an employee who is less overloaded, feels more secure in their job, feels they're being listened to or that they're getting the proper communications and has the resources, are getting adequately paid, and feel satisfied, again, in their particular position. Demonstrating long-term support is a key part. The literature supports this in all of the stress research that the individuals on the other end who filled out this instrument want to see their educational leaders demonstrate long-term support to this issue. Whether it's implementing an employee assistance program or committing additional resources, they want to see these things change. And using these dimensions of stress, again, to mitigate these stressors, how do we make them less of an issue so that they're not statistically significant at all in the future? And then finally, again, an important point to mention is that this is something that can be done immediately. And that was probably the most exciting part of the research is that it's actionable research. It's not something that is just an academic exercise and then we walk away from it. We can actually make some significant changes in organizations, not just the two that I studied, but anybody could pick up this dissertation down the road and look at it and go, here's some things that we need to look at in our institution. We can do something quick. We can do a shortened survey instrument, whether they use ASSET or some other instrument, or they can just pick up this research and transplant it to their organization and look at those five key areas that we found significant. Finally, areas that we think need future research. We think that there's a lot of exciting areas. First of all, and most importantly, we need more U.S. research in this particular area. Literature is not void of stress research in higher education, but it's traditionally focused. Elliott and Fisher in 1994 conducted research that dealt with just faculty and very small groups of faculty. Again, remember from the beginning I had said that Kaupins in 2004 identified that institutions tend to take a paternalistic view towards their students, but not towards their staff or their employees. And then when they do look at their employees, they traditionally look at faculty. And in many cases, you'll find in most institutions that staff outnumber faculty quite significantly. And that's evidenced through this particular literature. So we need more U.S. research base. An exciting part of this is I was the first U.S. researcher to use this instrument and the first researcher, in my opinion, at least from the literature I saw, that identified the differences in full-time and part-time faculty and staff as individual categories. That was supported by the literature in 2005 by Dr. Tidley, who said this is where we need to go. We need to study the differences in academics and in staff. We need some comparative researches. So we can really, I think, come out of this in some future research that I'd like to do myself is really to look at, do some comparative studies where we can really look at a worldwide standard. I think we can garner that from the strength of the ASSET instrument and the strength of the collective instrument, strength of the collective research in this particular area. And to me, that's really exciting that we could go and establish a standard or an inventory of higher education occupational stress so that any president or higher ed leader coming into an organization can say, these are red flags that I need to be aware of because the literature supports this. And that, to me, is something that's very exciting, but it's something for future research. Institutional differences, another key area that needs to be looked at. In this case, we dealt with a two-year and a four-year school. Institutional differences not only within the United States, but outside the United States need to be researched and looked at as well. What's the differences between higher education in the United Kingdom and the United States, Australia, and New Zealand? The instrument has been used in Greece and in other countries, in South Africa. What are the differences in those institutions in future research? And finally, one thing this instrument does not pick up are the emerging technologies. What do the new technologies that we use and what are the new teaching delivery systems, the new pedagogies, the new online teaching. What do those new systems do to stress on a campus? Is the online instructor less stressed, more stressed than someone who's on the ground campus, or does it make a statistically significant difference? So I think that moving in the future, we have a lot of exciting opportunities that you could take this research, build upon it, and come up with some really significant not only U.S. research, but worldwide research in these particular areas. Finally, I'd like to leave you with something that I thought was really interesting. In 2005, I came across this quote, and as Dr. Johnson will tell you, I like quotes and probably shouldn't use them as much as I do. But academic and administrative cultures are two separate and in many aspects competing domains. Put differently, faculty and administrators are known to hold different implicit models of their work environment. Faculty value scholarship, while administrators value organizational efficiency and accountability. That, I find, is the most fascinating part of the entire research project that I did, is you're taking something that is identifying there are significant differences between faculty and staff. Assuming those differences are there, there really aren't great differences because they all work for one institution, or higher education in general. We identified significance in five key areas. We ended up being the first, conducting the first U.S. research in this area. We isolated full-time and part-time faculty and staff members, and we found significant differences in those five areas. And I think we've been able to really contribute to an area of the multidimensionality of stress, something of great benefit to higher education leaders as they look to make changes in their organization, not down the road, but now, and provided them with actionable research to make some significant changes and differences in their environment. And that concludes a nutshell of 4 years of work, nearly. I will be happy to answer any questions at this point.
So if we were in a traditional class, give Jim a round of applause, right?
Yes.
So I think perhaps we should do that anyway. And then when Jim writes about his oral defense, he can say that there was applause heard literally around the country, right?
Yes, actually.
Isn't technology great?
It is.
Jim, that's an excellent presentation of your study. I'd like to know what questions the committee or other listeners might have at this point. Do any of the committee members have questions?
Well, Jim, you didn't look at any differences between men and women?
I did not. Actually,
okay.
In 2005, Dr. Trizoli had just completed a study looking at gender differences, and that is an area where we could do some future research as well, but I did not.
Okay. When you looked at health, was exercise a question there to see whether or not, and I know this is probably a question for further study, if respondents indicated that they were regular exercisers, participated in exercise regimen, maybe that affected their response.
We did. There are 105 items on the asset instrument, and one of them specifically dealt with exercise and how often individuals get exercise. We did not drill down to that level, but in both, there wasn't statistical significant differences in either psychological or physical well-being. Both populations that we studied were psychologically and physically unremarkable as far as our research results. Anecdotally, looking at the 227 instruments, I would say the vast majority of them, folks did not have a regimen of exercise. There were some, anecdotal comments in there about, wish I had more time to exercise and so forth. But I think that's important.
And the reason I address that is you always think about the big so what question is, okay, what are the curative factors that we could implement as practitioners to start to address issues of stress in the workplace? And I'm taking it from a student affairs perspective. If my staff feel overloaded or stressed, how can I help them take care of themselves
Right. Relative
to workplace stress? And so I'm just thinking about, what are those curative factors that I could do as administrator to make them feel less stressed?
I think that's an excellent question. I think the next level step when we do both institutional level data and future research part, the second part of an organizational stress screen is to say, why do I feel overloaded? Then looking at that particular isolated question and finding out what the results are, and then going to that population and seeing maybe perhaps doing different things at the fitness center, providing additional time during the day.
And also that may be a place or an appropriate place to kind of bring in some qualitative assessment research, and not real formal in nature, but to get those focus groups together to really talk about those employees, because they're the ones who know it better than we do. What stresses them out. They may not have the answer to what's going to help relieve their stress, but that's where the qualitative piece may come in handy.
You're correct. I think that we found that the individuals who were part of the study, again anecdotally, I think without having statistical significance here, found that they're not exercising, they're not doing the things I think they want to do. But the biggest part that I found that we didn't drill down to in this particular study, again, is good for a second part, is some of the major stressors were found to be caring for a sick relative, an elderly individual in the family, a disabled child, and there were some outside factors that were not. So everything, again, with a multidimensionality of stress, everything is not work-related. They come to work, and that's where the presenteeism comes in. They come to work with so many more problems that the work, then productivity and satisfaction, suffer, but it's not necessarily a result of a bad organization. It's a result of a lot of outside factors, and the studies show that as well.
Jim, let me ask a quick question and then pose a further question. The two institutions that you contained in this study are both unionized institutions.
That's correct.
Were the institutions in Great Britain unionized? Would you know that?
I do not believe they were. I don't believe Dr. Tidley's first study were not. I don't believe it was in 2005.
Were there any questions in ASSET that would allow you to zero in on that issue? In other words, did the unionized environment present stressors to employees that might not have been presented otherwise?
There's not a question, to the best of my recollection, there is not a question on ASSET that specifically addresses whether or not the institution is unionized or not.
Thank you.
I had a thought while you were making your presentation, and I wondered whether job security was affected by whether a faculty member was tenured or not.
Dr. Conley, there was not a section on the instrument to identify whether the employee was a tenured employee or not, only whether or not they were self-identified as a faculty or a staff member. But I think that's an excellent area for some future research.
As we talk about all those areas for future research, I had a similar kind of question, Jim. You and I have talked about this a little bit before. We don't really know at this point how selecting universities in other parts of the country might have impacted the results, and that kind of gets to Dr. Conley's question, because, you know, if we were doing, say, universities in the South where they're likely not unionized and in some instances don't even have tenure, I know it's not in your research, but what have you read, or do you have any thoughts about how that might have impacted your results?
It was something that both Dr. Tidley and I had talked about or exchanged emails about. Specifically looking at the not only cultural differences between continents, but looking geographically. In her area, she is looking at some future research that may allow her to study the differences between the studies in Australia versus the United Kingdom, New Zealand. That goes to the point of the future research of doing cultural differences. And cultural differences in our case, further research in the U.S. should look at geography. That's why I was specific to note its higher education stress in two upstate New York colleges, which may be dramatically different than Southwest, West Coast schools, and so forth.
Right.
So those cultural differences should be explored, but they were not for this study.
Now that leads to the idea of academic quality amongst institutions.
I think you're correct. There are a lot of threshold issues that would need to be flushed out in future research as far as standardizing the schools that we're looking at. In this case, we're as close as we could get with my population, with my target population, of two schools which are in relatively geographical similar areas. But I think you're correct. The quality of education, I think the last point that I had mentioned on future research dealing with new modalities is an online school. For example, the University of Phoenix versus Drexel University or another ground campus, how are those things all factored into the stress in the research in general?
Yeah, that's interesting. I couldn't help but compare in my mind as I heard your presentation that it seems as though the research, if you want to make a metaphor with a medical profession, would serve the purpose of diagnosis perhaps, but the area of treatment is what would remain a mystery. It'd be one thing to recognize stress and then another to try to mitigate it.
That's exactly right. And this research was focused on, is it a diagnosis? Yes. We diagnosed the institutions and tried to generalize as best we could to the entire population. That provides the foundation or the threshold, really, to now go into the door and sit in the room with those five areas and try to now flush them out, and how do we make those institutions and their employees more satisfied, more secure, less concerned about paying benefits, and so forth.
It's interesting. People are going to be stressed no matter what.
You're correct. Are there any other questions?
I'm going to step back a little bit from the specifics and just think in general about your research and how you conducted the study and all the steps that you followed and, you know, from choosing the topic forward. If you could start over today, and I know you don't really want to think about that, but if you could start over today, what might you have done differently in the study?
I would have wanted to drill down further. I think it was really more a product of time. I think the study design was sound from the perspective of using. I liked using the quantitative process. I think there is some inherent limitations to using a cross-sectional part. I would have rather done something more longitudinal. As the research suggests, that's the strength. But for what I had as far as an overall process, both the design, methodology, the benefits to higher education, leadership in general, I think those were fairly strong. But I would have rather done something a little more in-depth from the perspective of an instrument that looked beyond just the diagnosis.
Okay, great.
Well, and if I could follow up on that, I think that when I think about times of year that my staff experience more stress than other times, and I can speak for myself as well, I'm more stressed at the end of the second semester, toward the end of the year, than I am in the beginning of the year. And if we could predict that in the future, what interventions can we do with our staff so that they don't feel burned out, overloaded, exhausted at the end of that second semester?
Good point.
I mean, that's just an assumption, but it would have to be studied to quantify that.
Sure. Surely. Jim, you said you started the study with no real preconceived ideas. But if we think about that a little bit more, what one thing perhaps was there that you thought the study might show that it did not? Was there anything that just from your own experience or from gathering the literature or talking to the people, was there something that you thought would be more prevalent in the study than it is?
I thought that faculty, I think the results that we found, being a staff felt less satisfied. I thought I would find perhaps some different results from faculty. I don't have a higher education background. This is only my fourth year in higher education, and my perception only as a student, and actually, although I did not note it in my presentation here, there is a whole section in the dissertation that deals with the perception of faculty, which is they've got this great cushy job, and they have the summers off, and I think I almost expected to find that in the results. Now, there was not statistical significance achieved from faculty specifically in several areas, but that doesn't mean that they're not areas of the dimensions of stress that we still need to look at. What I found is that faculty certainly are at stress as changing modalities from online to ground and so forth. So I think that's the area that probably surprised me the most. I came in with that set of eyes looking at faculty and came out with a little different picture.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions for Jim? If not, at this time, the committee members need to remain on the line, and we need to have a brief discussion about how we move forward here with Jim's project, and we need to say goodbye to Jim and the other guests who are not part of the committee, and thank all of you very much for your time today and for your effort along the way in helping Jim and supporting Jim in this very, very exciting.
Certainly my pleasure, Dr. Connolly, thank you very much. And it was a pleasure to be with Jim in this process. He's a wonderful student, and he approached this dissertation as most of us who have gone through this process probably remember.
Dr. Jay, I'm going to step out of the room now, and let me turn the recording off, And I'm going to step out of the room so that you and Dr. Williams and Dr. Connolly can do your conference.
Thanks, Jim.
I'll separate. I'll just give me a second here to disengage the thing here.
All righty.